You're listening to Literacy Special Interest, a podcast produced for the Literacy Special Interest Group of ISTE, the International Society for Technology in Education. I'm your host, Mark Gura. Each episode, we'll review the latest and most significant developments in literacy education. We'll talk to prominent authors, influential educators, and thought leaders in the field. We'll explore the latest resources and exciting practices as well. Welcome to Literacy Special Interest. And welcome to episode number 4, The Drama of Literacy Learning. This episode features an in-depth interview with National Board Certified Teacher Mac Lewis, who's a widely read writer of plays and dramatized literature for young people published by Scholastic.
Well, before I became a teacher, I was trying to write and trying to get published. My work with Scholastic was really a stroke of good fortune. I was a charter subscriber to Scholastic Storywork magazine when it first came out, started using it in my classroom, and after a couple of years of using it, I looked at one of the plays and said, I can write those plays, and I sent it off to the editor. And she wrote me back and said, we're thrilled that a teacher is interested in writing for us. How about you try this? I think I've written probably 3 dozen plays for StoryWorks over the last 15 years. I've always had an interest in drama, but really the idea of using drama in the classroom became obvious to me when I took a workshop on what's called repetitive reading. When kids learn how to read, before they enter kindergarten or first grade, they read the same picture books over and over and over and over again. Well, there's all this brain research that says that's how kids learn to read. In third, fourth, fifth grade, they're not interested in repetitively reading the same picture book 17 times anymore. So you hand them a play script and say, you know, we're going to rehearse for this play. I want you to read your part. We're going to end up reading it 30 or 40 times by the time you perform it. Well, they're doing that same repetitive reading process, and yet they're not resistant to it at all. They're excited about the performance that comes at the end.
We'll also cover a range of powerful practices and resources for literacy, all relating to our theme, drama. We'll wrap our brains around the rich variety of practices possible in this area by looking at the book, Teaching Drama in the Classroom, a toolbox for teachers. We'll look at the article, Grading Oral Expression, a blind spot for teachers. We'll look at resources and practices involving the use of web-based recordings of vintage radio programs. And we'll explore in depth activities, resources, and student learning products in the area of digital animation. This episode wouldn't be complete without a segment on technology and readers theater. And so that's included as well. All of it in just a moment. I want to be sure to mention the book study underway by the Literacy Special Interest Group. And so you'll find links to the book, Teaching with Author Websites, and the book study blog, as you'll find links for everything and everyone covered in this podcast at the podcast show notes blog at www.literacyspecialinterest.blogspot.com. One of the ways that technology has made it far easier to integrate drama into the literacy classroom simply through the extraordinary amount of resources that the teacher can find via a simple Google search out on the web. Here's one that I came across just a little while back. It's a 20-page free PDF download, and it's titled Teaching Drama in the Classroom, a Toolbox for Teachers. And this appears actually to be the front matter, the index, and part of the first section of a really nice book put out by Sense Publishers and written by Joanne Kilgore-Dowdy and Sarah Kaplan. It's not a new book. I believe it's 1999, but it is still available from Amazon. I just checked. Both of these author editors, Joanne and Sarah, are from Kent State University. Of course, I'll give a link in the show notes blog to this worthwhile resource that's free on the web. And what I'm thinking about in recommending this really is the great overview you get of this whole possibility of having drama be prominent in the classroom simply through the table of contents. There's something like, 35 short chapters in this compendium devoted to practices. You know, it's one thing to want to integrate drama into what you do in the classroom, but it's quite another to really imagine the great variety of approaches possible and come up with a whole raft of solid ideas. And so leafing through this table of contents alone really helps with that. Some of this is kind of traditional. It discusses classic things for literacy classrooms like character development. And within that, there are some really interesting approaches too, like the use of comic strips and the use of photos and cartoons as prompts. And then some of it, even though this is a little bit older, it really gets at how digital media is the vehicle by which drama is staged in the popular culture. So there are some interesting ideas here, like creating a music video to enhance learning. This book goes into some really solid stuff like adapting literature for dramatic use in the classroom, touches on a wide variety of things from mime to interviewing. And then the book moves into storytelling. In a rather contemporary sense, there's an interesting little chapter there on movie scripts, drama and radio. We get taken through literature, through drama in history and social studies. If you want a quick overview of what a body of perhaps 30 smart educators put together as what's possible, what's relevant, take a look. Again, I'll give a link to this. It's out there on the web free. Definitely worth a few minutes of your time. Here's an interesting article from Education Week's Teacher Magazine Online, and this one is titled Grading Oral Expression, A Blind Spot for Teachers. It's written by Kyle Redmond, a fifth grade teacher at Marin County Day School in California. This is one of those articles that takes on the aspect of something of a professional confession. He's sharing that his own daughter's issues in being graded for oral expression at her high school has motivated him to reflect on his own professional behavior in his own classroom. And he concludes and explains in the article that because of all this, he's come to realize that when it comes to valuing oral expression, he really hasn't been following up or honoring it the way he feels he really ought to. And, you know, if you think about it, I think for so many of us, this really is a truth that's surfacing. While we often state that we value participation in class, we accept it, but then we slough it off and tend not to value it overtly through grades, for instance, as highly as written work. At any rate, it's a very good little discussion. I'll give a link to this article. And as I reflect on what's been expressed here, I realize that, well, one of the dimensions of this is that we simply don't record oral work in class. We're just not used to doing that, although technology now makes that relatively easy to do. You can use anything from a webcam to capture student oral work to a relatively inexpensive digital audio recorder. And of course, there are smartphones that come with that as a feature as well. It's not that hard to do if you wrap your brain around it. And so thinking about this, I realized that when we grade written work, well, not only is that something that we've developed deep-seated habits and procedures for, we know exactly how to do that. We know how to collect the written work. We know how to organize ourselves to grade it. And the written or word processed work is there for us to refer to again and again and again. Although student oral expression is often fleeting, comes and it goes in a matter of seconds. For many of us, we try to remember what's happened. We don't really have a permanent record to refer to. And so we really ought to think about this and try to tap one or more of these ever more commonly available technology tools to fix this situation. And of course, grading oral expression has everything to do with today's discussion about drama in the classroom, because we need a good, convenient place to begin this new practice. And by having our students engage in the performance, a natural extension of a great variety of drama practices in the classroom, we've got something to begin with, something to focus on. And so thanks, Kyle, for the thought-provoking piece. I think we've got something of a plan here. Okay, you caught me. I've just been spending the past hour or so watching Reader's Theater via YouTube, of course. I've been observing classes and schools from all over the world engaged in Reader's Theater. There really are some interesting performances uploaded on YouTube, and I'd recommend anyone check them out. Fascinating, for sure. Inspiring, absolutely. A lot to be learned from this easy way to focus in on some of the dynamics of live literacy. You know, if you share with a teacher the idea that drama is an aspect of learning that really ought to be in the classroom, you just might get that puzzled, "What are you talking about?" look. Or you just might get some recognition of the idea right away if the teacher makes the connection to Reader's Theater. Reader's Theater really is a very popular, very well-established practice. And if you haven't heard of it, I'll certainly provide some great links. There's one I can think of from Scholastic, among many, which will explain it and lay out its value for you. But apart from Reader's Theater, you really ought to consider that in so many ways, drama can make literacy come alive in the classroom. And I'll also add that technology in recent years has proven to be a vehicle by which this has been facilitated immensely, and we're going to explore some of that in this episode for sure. Phonemic awareness, phonics, vocabulary, fluency, and comprehension. These five components of teaching reading provide a great foundation. But how do we move students from learning those skills to becoming engaged, thinking readers? We immerse them in the experience of reading aloud. And I wish I'd said that, but actually that's from a very nice article written by Kathy Puitt Miller titled "The Read Aloud Experience," published online at the Education World website. I'll add that if what you're after with your students is instilling an appreciation for and love of literature, if you're trying to model voice, or if what you want to do is demonstrate a wonderful vehicle for personal expression, reading aloud is one of the very best things you can do with young learners. Ms. Pruitt also offers a few tips about how to get this done. I really like that she advises to present the read aloud as an enjoyable experience, and she also advises to choose materials of interest to your students and think outside the box. Okay, let's do a little bit of that right now. We can learn a little bit of 20th century history and gain some important ahas about popular culture by taking a look at the age of radio. And there are some resources out there on the web with some startlingly wonderful potential for excitement in the classroom in the area of drama and oral literacy. Here's one. It's actually a webquest titled Radio Days. I haven't heard much about webquests over the past few years. It was a very popular format at one time in the beginning of educational technology. Still has a lot of validity. And this one, and certainly we'll give a link to it, offers content, activities, resources. It even discusses the process involved in making radio, gives some evaluation tools, quite a bit. I especially like that it structures and models collaboration. So in the process portion of the activities laid out here, well, let me read a little bit. Step one, each person in your group is to select one of the following positions. A job description for each position is included. And so there is playwright, Foley artist, that's really a sound effects artist, advertising executive as well. But of course, you can modify this by creating your own positions. One of those might be performer. This goes on through a number of stages. In step one, for instance, let me read again from it. Once each group member has selected a job, you are to research the history of radio drama. Your boss believes that you cannot create an effective radio drama without knowing some of the history of the art. This goes on to structure and motivate online research about radio. And step three, each of the positions or roles assigned a task. The playwright, for instance, is shown a format to write a radio play script, and there are several modeled, like the 1938 War of the Worlds radio broadcast, which always is a startling thing. And this goes on, and through the stages, the students will actually produce their own radio show. For instance, in step six, the directions say rehearse your radio drama, including the commercials and sound effects. Make sure that you put a lot of emotion and feeling into your reading of the script. And that's exactly what we're after. And finally, let me read from step seven. It says, record your drama. If you have the capability, create a podcast and turn it into your boss for final approval. And immediately following that is a long list of online resources, actually links to audio files of authentic vintage radio shows. I think I've given you a feel for what this very exciting webquest is all about. I'll give a link and you can check it out on your own.
I was sick unto death with that long agony. And when at length they unbound me and I was permitted to sit, I felt that my senses were leaving me. The sound of the inquisitorial voices seemed merged in one dreamy, indeterminate hum from which emerged the syllables of my name.
Sorry. Just couldn't resist. Actually, I lifted that little snippet from a wonderful website called Relic Radio. You'll find recordings there of many, many, many classic radio shows. The site states that it believes them all to be in public domain. What a wonderful source of material to motivate, to contextualize this sort of dramatic reading from literature, to model how it's done, and just to appreciate it when it's done really well. We'll give the link to Relic Radio. And of course, if you do a little searching around, you'll find other such resources on the web too. In fact, there's just so much out there that the creative teacher can tap and put to the purpose of getting our kids more literate. Another very rich, high motivation approach that centers on drama is animation. First off, I'll point out that animation can be inexpensive or even free, certainly easy to do with classes of students. Assuming, of course, that you've got computers for the group, either one-to-one or one per small group, there are numerous approaches that follow a whole raft of software options, some free, one that's probably already in your possession, some for a very low cost, and some for a modest price. But first, let's consider the connection. Just how does animation bring drama alive in the classroom, and how does it foster the acquisition of literacy skills? Animation is strong on giving the listening and speaking dimensions of literacy a workout, although reading and writing are part of it as well. And in fact, all of these separate skills are thoroughly intertwined in a real-world application at that. It's a type of activity that generates a very high degree of student investment in the learning. It really doesn't get much better than that. What does animation offer for literacy learners? A relevant context, a tech-supported platform from which literacy skills make sense, feel like fun, and are acquired effectively. So, here are the four tools I'll recommend and cover today. And of course, there are many more that a simple Google search for student animation resources will reveal. Number one is PowerPoint. Yes, PowerPoint can be used for animation. Two is something called Domo Animate, which is a free online resource. Three is Extranormal, a very interesting resource. Imagine, if you can, a tool set that generates what we could describe as animated virtual reality puppets that can be programmed to speak in a variety of accents and give facial and body gestures as well. And four is an old standby, Frames, which is put out by Tech for Learning. And I understand they just released a new version 5 of it. Now, let me run down each one with an explanation of advantages and applications. PowerPoint has many digital storytelling capabilities. You can illustrate with its basic shapes functions, or you can insert or import kids' drawings, either drawings they did digitally in a software program, or that they did with conventional materials, like crayons, and then scan them, save them in JPEG or other graphic file format, and bring them into PowerPoint. You can record narration right in PowerPoint using either an inexpensive external mic, and those can be easily purchased in the $10 to $20 range, or just use the microphone that's built into virtually every laptop or netbook sold over the last decade. You can also use the call-outs feature of PowerPoint to attach a dialogue balloon or a thought bubble, just like the writer artists do in comic books and graphic novels. And PowerPoint can also be used for the classic type of animation in which many images, each slightly different from the previous one presented, are shown in rapid succession. To do that, after each image is inserted into its own slide, use the timed transitions feature of PowerPoint to advance the slides automatically, very quickly, one after the other. This is a technique that works great, involves the use of a piece of software that you probably already have installed on your computers and that your students may very well be familiar with already. I devoted a section of the book I wrote for ISTE, Visual Arts Units, All Levels, to student animation projects done using PowerPoint. I went to some lengths there to illustrate and show how to use PowerPoint in the book for this purpose, and I'll give a link to ISTE books for it if you're interested. Number two is a very easy to use online resource. In other words, you're going to use it completely online and it's free. This is an animation resource that's easy to use and it's probably a great deal of fun for kids to work with. It doesn't do everything, but it certainly is a platform in which kids can easily create animated, moving, emoting, cartoon-like characters, and then keyboard in dialogue that they write for them. And boy, there's a lot of motivation and literacy value in that. So as I was searching around out there on the web for some examples or good resources to explain this, I came across a really nice blog, which is titled Welcome to NCS Tech. It's put out by Kevin Jarrett, who describes himself on the blog as the K-4 computer teacher and technology facilitator at Northfield Community School. That's a great little blog you have there, Kevin. And this particular post has the headline, Let Kids Learn Animation et domo animate. And I'm quoting Kevin, this free website, which uses email-based registration, is extremely easy to use. Here's a look at the interface, and he includes some effective screenshots. He explains, the beauty of sites like these is that kids don't have to spend a great deal of time learning the tool. They can instead devote time to developing a strong story with effective dialogue, envisioning detailed scenes, making sure the story gets told just the way they want it. Kids will want to experiment with it, at first to understand the tools and characters that are available, but that won't take long. So the key is to focus on the planning and work before creating the actual movie. And I totally agree with you, Kevin. You nailed it in terms of the value and the process as it's presented to us. And he goes on and gives a very nice embedded video example of a student project using Domo Animation. I highly recommend you check out Domo Animation, and I can't think of a better place for you to check it out than Kevin's blog.
Apparently, he pioneered metric measurement just to make his shoe size sound bigger. Brilliant!
Now we come to our third resource, Extra Normal, which as a technology resource for student learning is extraordinary in a great many ways. So try to imagine, if you can, a resource in which students use drag and drop style programming. Very easy. Selecting pieces and putting them together online to locate characters and dress them and give them one's own spin, assign them animated actions to take on the screen, and then to select for them a voice and an accent, perhaps, certainly a voice with a good deal of personality, and then program that voice for that animated puppet-like character simply using keyboarding. And what one gets is a rather startling, if not slightly robotic, effect, but it is extra normal and extraordinary.
Attitude is a little thing that makes a big difference.
Oh dear boy, have you seen those shoulder pads?
A little bit harder to use this particular tool set, but if you feel you can bear with it, there's a lot of fruit it will bear. High motivation, highly engaging, I'm sure. Startling result, startling student learning product to be produced from this, absolutely. I'll give a link to the resource itself. It's not free, but it's definitely low cost. Somewhere on the order of $10 for the teacher and 50 cents for the student. I'll also give a link to some startling examples. And for anyone who might be doubtful that this is an appropriate literacy-rich resource that would lend itself to a wide variety of literacy skill fostering activities, I'm going to give a link to a very nice article written by a third grade teacher. This is from Scholastic.com in their area titled Classroom Solutions. The article's headline reads, Persuasive Writing 21st Century Style, Extra Normal Movie Making. And so very briefly, in this article, the teacher author is sharing how she engaged her students in a really worthwhile writing assignment, modeling some of it with traditional sock puppets, but then moving on to making very contemporary extra normal movies. Definitely worth a read. I highly recommend this article. Finally, we come to a piece of software from Tech for Learning. The piece is titled Frames. It's been around for a long time. Although it's not free, it's at what I would describe as a modest price, certainly worth the expense. This is a more traditional approach. Tech for Learning, by the way, gives a great deal of background, contextualizing information for the teacher. In fact, because time is precious here, I'm not going to go into a great explanation, but I will give a link and direct you to their website where you'll find some really nicely prepared videos that will explain how to use frames, and more importantly, will really give a good grounding in how animation can be used to foster learning across the curriculum, and from our perspective today, in literacy learning in particular. This is really good stuff. Whether you purchase it or not, check out their videos. It will definitely make understanding all of this a great deal easier. Oh, and before we finish this segment on animation, I'm going to give you some links to some great free resources that can be used for animation projects or plain old digital storytelling or related practices. So if you're having your students write original stories, here are some great free resources from the wonderful website Read, Write, Think. And these are resources that you can print out and reproduce. These all are in that family of thing that are usually described as graphic organizers. So there's a character map. Students can use this particular tool to examine what a character looks like, what a character does, how other characters react to him or her. There's a conflict map, which guides students in examining the critical plot element of conflict in the story they're writing. There's a sequence of events chart, which helps students see the sequential or cause and effect between multiple events in their story. There's also a narrative pyramid, which students can use to reflect on key ideas and details in their story. And also from a wonderful body of free resources on the web titled Primary Access, there are storyboard resources. Storyboards are graphic organizer type resources that help students do all of the things I was describing in the Read, Write, Think resources, but combined just the way professional movie makers would begin the process. And that's it on this segment about animation. And if you do some nice animation projects with your students, please email the podcast and let us know about it. Maybe we'll feature it in an upcoming episode. You're listening to Literacy Special Interest, the podcast of the Literacy Special Interest Group of ISTE, the International Society for Technology in Education. Before we move on to part two, our in-depth interview with Mac Lewis, a classroom teacher and a popular writer for the magazines and books put out by the publisher Scholastic, a reminder to visit our podcast show notes blog, which you'll find at www.literacyspecialinterest.blogspot.com. And there you'll find links to all the articles, resources, and other items covered in the podcast, as well as information about the Literacy Special Interest Group and how to contact me, your host, Mark Gura. Be sure to listen to upcoming episodes of this podcast. Among the numerous literacy learning items presented will be insightful interviews with folks like Andrea Davis Pinckney, the New York Times best-selling and award-winning author of many books for children and young adults. I spoke with Andrea at length about literacy learning and her recently published book, Bird in a Box, hailed by the New York Times as a powerful middle grade novel. It's on the theme of the boxer Joe Louis and young people finding hope during the Great Depression. Down the road, we'll also have an in-depth interview with Jeff Piontek, former principal of the internationally known charter school Hawaii Technology Academy. Jeff was a keynote presenter at the ISTE conference and the author of blogs, wikis, and podcasts, Oh My, Electronic Media in the Classroom, put out by Shell Education. And now for my interview with Young People's author, Mac Lewis. Mac, hi, this is Mark Gura. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Mark. Nice to hear your voice.
I have with me Mr. Mac Lewis, who is a teacher and an author. And, well, Mac, thanks very much for giving us some of your valuable time for Literacy Special Interest Podcast.
No, you're welcome.
What we often do on this podcast is we interview authors, some of them quite prominent. And obviously, the work of authors is one of the things that teachers focus on with students in the language arts class and in other classes that are fostering literacy. And you know, we've had some authors with us, like Patricia Polacco and T.A. Barron, who write wonderful fiction, some of it as picture books, some of it as chapter books, some of it as kind of straight-ahead juvenile novels. But you're in another category, and I'm thinking your experience is going to be very valuable to us. Number one, you're a classroom teacher, and you're also a published author. As I understand it, most of what you publish is with Scholastic.
Correct. I write for primarily the Classroom Magazine divisions.
So you write for Scholastic's magazines, which are, why don't you tick them off for us?
Okay, StoryWorks magazine is a wonderful language arts magazine designed for grades 4 through 6, basically. And I got my start with StoryWorks 1998, I think, their original year. I just kind of got lucky and stumbled upon them and started using the magazine at that time. Since then, I've developed relationships with Scope magazine, a language arts magazine for the middle school grades. And just recently I started writing for Junior Scholastic, which focuses on upper middle school, junior high. And then I've also written for Scholastic News a couple of times, which is their kind of long-term traditional classroom publication they've been famous for, I don't know, 40 years or something.
You know, your brain is a great opportunity for us to pick. So you're a classroom teacher and you use published material in the class with your students, and then you write material that's published. And in my mind, the great distinction there for you as an author is that you're writing specifically a material that's intended to be used in the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, what I tend to do, you know, perhaps because I've got a creative bent, when I have a need to cover a certain subject matter in the classroom, I would prefer to go out and create my own material rather than search and find something that might sort of fit but might not be quite what I want. So I'll just create that. And so I create classroom plays on whatever subject matter that I need to cover at a given time.
Well, you know, I think that's just about perfect. It's very organic. You're looking for material in the classroom, and so you create the material that you think would be perfect for your purpose. And why don't you give us just a little background? Let's start with the teaching. So what do you teach, and where do you teach?
Well, I teach the elementary grades. Right now, grades 4 and 5 at Central Point Elementary School in Southern Oregon, and I've been teaching here in the Southern Oregon area for about 20 years, typically in the elementary grades 3, 4, 5.
And are you the classroom generalist, or do you teach as a specialist?
I'm a generalist. However, because our class sizes have become so inordinately large, we're doing more deployment these days, and so I'll end up focusing primarily on right now fifth grade language arts and fourth grade math, and then everything else is kind of just on the periphery of those two subject areas. I try to build all of my curriculum around a year-long study of American history, and so most of what I teach integrates with history, which again facilitates that idea of writing my own material. So if I'm at a certain place in history and I want to get across some dynamic concept, creating a play or my own written material on that subject tends to get to the point quicker.
So actually, you have your eye on the social studies content, and that becomes a vehicle for a lot of literacy learning.
Absolutely. Yeah, no question.
So the other side of my question then is, so how do you come to be a writer, an author? Is this part of a lifelong career plan? Is it something that just happened? Is it your way of satisfying, you know, some personal need? You know, how did that evolve for you?
Well, here's the tip my hat to all the struggling writers out there, because I've been a struggling writer for 30 years or so. So well before I became a teacher, I was trying to write and trying to get published. And it's tough. I mean, the writing market is a tough market to crack. My work with Scholastic was really a stroke of good fortune. I was, a charter subscriber to Scholastic Storywork magazine when it first came out, and started using it in my classroom. And after a couple of years of using it, I looked at one of the plays and said, I can write those plays. And so I created an adaptation of the Peter Rabbit story, and I sent it off to the editor, and hoping that I would finally break through and get something in a national publication. And she wrote me back and said, no, we don't want this one, but we're thrilled that a teacher is interested in writing for us. How about you try this? And she gave me an assignment to write an adaptation of A Christmas Carol, and put that together for her. Went off well, and I've been writing for that particular editor ever since. I think I've written probably 36 plays for Storyworks over the last 15 years.
That's a great story. Really, the writing is something you've always done, but it clicked for you as a teacher looking for the right material. I think that's a great story indeed. So, one of the things that really interests me about your work, Mac, is that you're so involved with drama or dramatized literature. You know, it's one of the pillars of literacy, but I don't get a chance to talk to many people who write that way. But I guess that's what seems natural to you, huh?
Yeah, I've always had an interest in drama, but really the idea of using drama in the classroom became obvious to me when I took a workshop on what's called repetitive reading, and talked about how when kids learn how to read, when they learn how to read before they enter kindergarten or first grade often, and the way they do that is they read the same picture books over and over and over and over again, and they come to mom or dad, and my kids were the same way. They come to us and they say, can we read this one again? And it's like, we've read that one 17 times already, Johnny. And Johnny doesn't care. He wants to read this one. And next thing you know, Johnny's reading it to us. And we just say, oh, he's memorized it. That's all he's done. He's heard it so many times, he's memorized it. Well, there's all this brain research that says that's how kids learn to read, that they're actually growing the synapses in the brain that make reading possible by that connection and that positive feedback of, oh, you've got that, Johnny. You're reading that book. So you get those kids in third, fourth, fifth grade. Well, they're not interested in repetitively reading the same picture book 17 times anymore, correct? So you hand them a play script and say, we're going to rehearse for this play. I want you to read your part today, and we're going to read it in class again tomorrow, and you're going to read it for homework the next night. And we're going to end up reading it 30 or 40 times by the time you perform it. Well, they're doing that same repetitive reading process that they would have done before they started school, and yet they're not resistant to it at all. They're excited about the performance that comes at the end. One of the keys is, of course, having a performance at the end, and I'll talk more about that when we're ready, I suppose.
I think that's a fascinating way of explaining the approach, and maybe it's just a little bit sneaky too.
No question, yeah.
These kids need repetitive reading. They're not interested in the kind of repetitive reading they did when they were little ones. So you've found a context that makes repetitive reading make perfect sense functionally for them. I think that's fantastic.
As educators, we have this tendency to think, we're going to hand Johnny a text and say, read it. He's never seen it before. To liken it to a musician, you hand him a piece of music. They're not going to immediately just be able to hammer out that piece of music and play it perfectly. Yet that's what we're asking kids to do with their reading. And at elementary level, they are beginning readers, and they need that practice and that reinforcement that comes with reading a text more than once. And they never get that in school. So drama is one of the few ways that we can facilitate that.
Well, that explains a good part of your fascination with this approach, and I guess you like plays as well. I'm sure that's the case too, huh?
I do like plays, and the kids like plays. You know, once again, we're talking about student engagement, and oftentimes it's really difficult to get kids engaged in, certainly a traditional textbook, and sometimes even, literature. It's hard to engage them in it. But plays, they tend to be, even the shy ones, are excited about participating in a play. There's an art to finding the right role for a shyer student, but even those kids that are reluctant readers will get excited about being in a play.
So for the listeners who are primarily language arts teachers, or maybe even social studies teachers who are sensitive to literacy learning, this is really something worth trying, because I'm not so sure that every teacher really goes down this road other than to do the required little bits of drama. And you're really framing this as a whole approach. Before we talk about some of your specific works, Mac, comment, if you can, a little bit about how you see the materials you produce, primarily for Scholastic play format. How do you see that used, or recommend it be used, in class?
The way I see any play in a Scholastic publication used is an opportunity for a teacher to have kids put themselves in character, to read the material more than once so that they get that repetitive reading component, to get engaged in a reading activity. You hand a kid an article and say, read that article, and he may or may not buy into it. But if you build an activity around it, such as a performance, even if it's just a short in-class performance, I think kids get more engaged in it, and they're going to pick up more of the gist of the message that's in the play or the script. I can see, in a junior high school class where you have kids that are generally stronger readers, and you hand them a short play script, they're usually about 1,300 words in junior Scholastic, and you have them go off in a corner, that group of 10 kids go off in the corner and rehearse that little play for 10 minutes, and then come back and stand in front of the class, and with their personality and their funny voices, or however they want to act it out, that they read that in front of the class, usually their personality comes out and they're engaged. I can think back to when I was in high school, and although I'd become a lover of books in high school, I don't think I read anything. But I had a high school teacher who would have us read from scripts. I remember reading Duck Soup, and I can't tell you offhand who the playwright was. But as a group, we sat down, and we're reading Duck Soup in class. And it was a blast. And it was one of the things that I remember most about my high school literacy experience. So I would imagine kids in my classroom have that same feeling. They're not necessarily remembering the articles we read, but I'll bet you they're remembering the plays that they read.
So plays are inherently communal activities, and inherently they're really about being performed. And so, that's really the approach to take with this. These are not homework assignments or, read by yourself type assignments. This is for the group to go through together and to prepare as a performance, even if it's just an in-class performance.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good way to put it. This is about teamwork and collaboration.
You know, the other thing that strikes me about these plays you write, Mac, is that so many of them are really what I'll call dramatizations. They're really classic short stories and short stories that have been taught for many years. I remember some of these when I was a junior high school student. But, traditionally, Mac, they're presented to students as collections of short stories, and you've gone ahead and made plays out of them. And maybe there's even more than one collection. Let's talk about this book you put out for Scholastic, classic short stories. In fact, I have it here in front of me, and kind of the subtitle is Read Aloud Plays. I'm looking at the table of contents. Very attractive publication, by the way, some nice illustrations. So as I was starting to say, there's some real classic ones here. There's Poe's The Telltale Heart, and there's Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and A Christmas Carol, and I see you have Gogol here, which is something I'm not used to seeing, but most of it is classic. I see you have Rudyard Kipling's Rikki Tikki Tavi, but again, those are very traditional, but traditionally presented in short story format.
Correct. What I see a lot of teachers doing with that is they'll take, for example, A Telltale Heart, and they'll have their class do the play version, and then they'll have their class read the original version and do a compare and contrast between the play and the original. And, you know, the teachers are telling me that what they discover is that the kids are more engaged in reading that original text because they've done the play, or vice versa. So that really brings it together. I also have another version of Telltale Heart that's a modernized version that I sell on my website. And so when they do all three of them, then they're really hammering Telltale Heart home, and kids, of course, embrace it and love it to death. So that's kind of the gist of the classic short stories is, you know, you compare it to the original, and kids are, once again, more engaged.
So many of these have been made into movies or done, you know, on the stage that it seems absolutely natural that you would present this, at least in part, to youngsters, you know, as drama. And I see your point. Why not read it in both ways and, you know, have both approaches enrich each other? That makes perfect sense to me. Do you have any other collections like that one?
I also have a collection called Symbols of America, which are American history plays. And they all focus on a national monument or a holiday, and kind of gives an opportunity to dramatize for example, the meaning of President's Day.
So that's a collection of short plays, and there's a dozen plays. How many would we find in that collection?
I think that one has, if I recall correctly, I think that one has 10. And Classic Short Stories, I think, has 8. My favorite of the classic short stories, by the way, is the Gogol play, The Nose, which is just it's a piece of literary farce, and it's just hysterical, especially when you shorten it up and you put it in kid friendly language. It's just a wonderful play.
Well, we were saying before, Mac, that you write these with your own teaching and your own students in mind. And I gather your students are not especially high-functioning. They're kind of average students. Is that fair?
They're, you know, it's pretty typical fifth grade level kids. Yeah, public school. You've got a very diverse environment there.
So you write these plays for the typical student, maybe your own students, And I gather you actually bring this into class at some point, or much of it.
Oh yeah, yeah. Pretty much everything I write, I use in the classroom because, again, I'm trying to multitask. Really, I'm trying to create stuff for the market, but at the same time, I'm trying to fulfill my needs in the classroom and cover the content that I believe needs to be covered. So, yeah, just about everything I write ends up used in the classroom in some form or another.
Second-guessing your process, I would imagine that you're looking for the success factor and the student acceptance factor, and so probably you're monitoring your own work with an eye towards how you're refining your own writing process for students down the road.
Yes, absolutely. You have a nice way of putting things, Mark. Yeah.
We were saying before that social studies is a major theme of yours, and so I'm looking at another item, which is, it's an original play this time. So this is not something you adapted. It's an original play based on the U.S. Civil War. It's called Freedom for the First Time, and why don't you tell us a little bit about that? The subtitle is A Slave's Narrative.
you know, that's one of my favorite pieces. And I wrote that originally for Storyworks, and for one reason or another, it never made it into print. And so then I republished it for my website, to sell on my website. And, of course, obviously I've used this in my classroom, but this is a play based on real slaves' narratives.
It's based on a real slave's narrative. So how did that come about?
Well, my editor at Storyworks gave me a book called Day of Jubilee. And inside there, the author has a number of actual slaves' narratives, dozens of them. And you see the actual printing of of that slave from the 1860s or so, writing about their experience. And so I took a lot of those different pieces and I put them together and created a fictional one, although it's based on real incidents. It's just been kind of combined with different ones to make more of a story. And so this is a story about a group of slaves living on a plantation where, when the Civil War breaks out, and the slave owners convince them that they're on their side, and that Abraham Lincoln and these Union soldiers are looking to ruin their lives, and so these slaves need to stick with old Mrs. and her sons. And they've got these slaves convinced so much that the slaves are willing to go off to fight for the South. And but of course they don't. They stay there on the plantation. And over the course of the story, they begin to realize that, this isn't quite right, that there's more to this story than the slave owners have let them in on. And the play concludes with the Civil War ending and the slaves being emancipated. There's a device in the story. It has to do with a mother slave's youngest daughter is taken off to the big house at the beginning of the war to serve as an apprentice maid. And they know that they never see the kids when they go off to the big house. They're no longer part of the family. But when the Civil War ends and they're emancipated, she gets to march up to the big house and get her daughter back. And that's a pretty powerful moment as she reclaims her youngest child. Anyway, love the play. It's a great play, and the kids enjoy acting that one out, and they get to speak in Southern dialect, and they learn a lot about the Civil War and the hardships of slavery as a result of it.
Well, I bet the dialect is something that fascinates them, too. Certainly a lot of fun.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, without diluting the importance of the story, yeah, they have a lot of fun with it.
Now, as an aside, I'm wondering, do you ever stage these plays?
Oh, yeah. Particularly when I have strong groups or a modest-sized class, it's easy to stage them. I'll run three play groups at a time, and we'll work towards putting them on stage. They're only about 20 minutes in length, and we don't do anything fancy necessarily, although I have done full productions that basically they're just getting up in front of the stage and acting it out, and they'll bring their own props if they want to. I don't require that they memorize their part, because again, I'm interested in them doing the repetitive reading, so they'll have their scripts up there with them. Oftentimes other kids will memorize their lines and get up there and deliver them as if they're Tony Award-winning actors or whatever.
And is there an audience there?
Oh, yeah. I'll invite other classes from the school. I'll just post it and say, we have a group performing this play at this time, and other classes will show up to watch it.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic, particularly because it's kind of casual, Like, this play is happening, and you're welcome to sit and enjoy it if you like.
Right. I used to teach at a different school, and in that particular school, the classroom was such that I was able to actually build a stage inside the classroom, complete with curtains and everything. And I was known for every month there'd be a trio of plays, and classes could come and see a new trio of plays and right in my classroom. And that was pretty nifty. Now, in this newer school, don't have the ability to put a stage in my classroom, but we do have a very nice stage that's in our music room. Unfortunately, due to budget cuts and overcrowding, I don't have access to it this year, so I've had to take a different approach to enacting the plays.
Well, whatever the venue, I think having this program in an ongoing fashion, what a wonderful enrichment for the culture of the school. That's exactly the way it strikes me, Mac. I can just about imagine how this enriches the community of learners there, you know.
Yeah, I love it so much that, and the kids love it so much that I can't not do it. I have to do it. Even this year when I have 39 kids in my class this year, which is really too many to run play groups successfully. Yet, as painful as it is, we're still running these play groups because these kids say, you know, Mr. Lewis, when are we going to do a new play? And so I'll start another, I have to do 4 plays at a time right now because the groups are so big, but I'll start another 4 plays after spring break mid-month, and yeah, we'll just keep on going. You know, this is a good time to talk about what we're doing with podcasts now. After meeting you and talking with you and learning a little bit about podcasts, I've used that as an alternative way to present plays, and that's gone over real well. The kids are having a blast recording the plays and hearing them posted on the internet.
If some aspect of your core instructional program there is something the kids are asking for, insisting on, you're hitting home runs. That's just an ideal situation. So obviously there's something very right about this approach. I know some of the people listening are going to want to know how to acquire some of these materials you've written. So we've talked, Mac, about how much of this is published by Scholastic, and I doubt there are many teachers in the U.S. who are unfamiliar with Scholastic. And, you know, I took a quick look online. I think most of these things are for sale or part of a subscription at very fair and modest prices. But there are other ways they can get some of your materials as well, I think.
Yes, and we've talked before about Teachers Pay Teachers, which is a site where teachers create and market their own materials online. And I have a storefront at Teachers Pay Teachers. That's accessible through my own website, which is simply maclewis.com. And I have a number of plays featured on there. And just about everything I've written ends up at Teachers Pay Teachers at some point or another.
Just to recap for the listeners, because there are a lot of people aware of Teachers Pay Teachers, but an awful lot of folks still haven't come across it. So Teachers Pay Teachers is a website. It's a web-based resource, and it's kind of an open marketplace where accomplished teachers who've produced what I'll call, you know, really polished pieces of curriculum offer them for sale. And it's easy to navigate and easy to use. There's a lot of material there. There's a lot of teachers who participate, and you can do a search through that, or you can go directly to look for someone like Mac Lewis's work. And it's for sale, but at what I consider to be pretty fair prices. Typically, what would it cost someone to acquire one of your play materials there?
Well, so for example, we mentioned earlier Freedom for the First Time, and that play is available as a class set for $3. So for $3, a teacher downloads that play, prints it themselves, and then they have license to print a class set of that every year for use in their own classroom.
That's a very fair price. It's beyond fair. You also offer materials free of charge, and you do materials other than these plays as well, although that's what we're talking about today. So it's worth checking out Mac's website to see what he's offering there. And let's talk about the podcast. So recently you came to podcasting, and I appreciate the tip of the hat that some of my podcasting efforts got you thinking about doing this. So, but let's be fair about this. You understand technology a bit, but you're really not a technologist. You wouldn't describe yourself that way, would you?
Well, I don't. Other people do. They keep saying I'm the techie teacher in our school district. And yet really what I am is a teacher who's just looking for avenues to do neat things for kids. And so I have a pretty elaborate website, and all my students have their own web pages that they build with me, and things of that nature. But this year, because we're short on space in our building and we don't have access to our stage so easily, I had to come up with a different way for them to produce their plays so that they still had motivation to go through that whole month-long series of rehearsals. And podcasting became an obvious one after I heard some of yours on Talking Finlit and on this program. So I went out and found myself an inexpensive omnidirectional microphone and downloaded Audacity software and tried it for the first time and ended up with, right now I have three plays that the kids just did for Black History Month on my website and on their, also on their school website. So in class, they can click on it, or at home, they can click on it, and they can hear their performance just as they delivered it. And it's been kind of a neat experience, especially with the software that allows us to edit and manipulate their voices a bit. That's been a lot of fun as well.
Well, let's talk just a little bit about some of the how-to. So you were motivated to do this. You could see this as a kind of next-level outlet, a natural extension of what you've been doing already, and that makes great sense to me. You came to podcasting the best way, in my opinion, Mac, not because you had heard about podcasts and thought they were kind of a neat thing to do, but you had an organic need to go in that direction, and you know, I'm sure reflecting on it, recording and saving these performances is a missing element. And I'll share with the audience that the free downloadable software you're using for your podcasts, which is called Audacity, is the same one I use for this podcast, Literacy Special Interest. It works great, even though it's free. And what did you use for a microphone?
I got a microphone called a Samson Go Mic. And it was around $40, and it's just a little tiny thing. It's designed for a laptop. And so I've got my Audacity software on a laptop, and then it's a plug-and-play mic. I just plugged it in and followed the directions, and my mic was up and running. And I can set it in a group. I'll get about 10 kids around a small table, and I'll just put that mic in the middle, and I'll have the laptop sitting in my lap, and we'll go. And it's been great. It may not be the absolute best quality, but for our purposes, it's marvelous.
Great. And I'm glad you touched on that big question mark, the classroom management. So to do podcasting with students, you don't need to have every kid with his own podcasting set up. I'm guessing you'll agree with me that the most appropriate way to do it is as a class activity. So you really only need one laptop and one microphone, and you're getting a satisfactory result, huh?
Correct, yes. And I pulled that one group out at a time. So again, I've got 39 kids, so I've got four different play groups that go. So I'll have three of the play groups doing a classroom activity with my educational assistant or seat work or something, and then I'll pull the other 8 or 9 or 10 kids out into a side room and record our play that way. And that worked really well. And it's also a lot less stressful than trying to run a full stage performance. So that's an added bonus.
Well, yeah, there are a number of ways of doing it. I think your approach is very smart. And of course, you probably could have the rest of the class sit there as the audience too, and avoid the what do I do with the rest of the kids issue. And you know,
I think that is definitely a possibility, no question.
You know, at some point maybe we can circle back and interview you again when you get some more experience doing this, because I think you have some great insights on this. Anyhow, Mac Lewis, thanks so much for your time. You're generous with it, and you've given us some great food for thought for a Literacy Special Interest podcast.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate your time as well.
You've been listening to Literacy Special Interest, a podcast produced for the Literacy Special Interest Group of ISTE, the International Society for Technology in Education. That cool background music is called Sunny Day by Mastermind XS, which you can find at FMA, Free Music Archive. And a link for that, as well as all the resources discussed on the podcast, is available at the show notes blog at literacyspecialinterest.blogspot.com. I'm your host, Mark Gura, and I'll be back with the next episode soon.